My pro tip about getting the writing done is bring your laptop into the bathroom. And also never
Ooh,
borrow my laptop.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And
I'm
a
writer.
Writer, bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Zach Dotson, who's the author of Bats of the Republic and one of the founders of Featherproof Books, which published my first book, Daddies. He currently teaches design and visual narrative in New Zealand, where he also studies for a PhD in creative writing. Welcome, Zach.
Welcome.
I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited too. I had no idea you were studying for a PhD.
Me neither. It surprises me every time I hear about it.
Is there anything you can't do?
Yes, a PhD. Seriously, guys, this is my favorite podcast. I want you to know, I think I've emailed that to you before, but every week I wait for it to come out. I download it. I listen to it straight through. I abandon my family. I'm like, I got to go on a walk. And
thank you. It.
Thanks, Zach.
I honestly... If you did anything less, I would be pissed.
Yeah, same. Absolutely.
As two Aries, we demand total supplication.
Love.
Love. Yeah, yes.
All of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, you have my complete devotion. Like, is there a ranking system for fans? I want to be like number one.
You're number one.
I want to be like president of the Butthead fan club or whatever
absolutely.
It is. I want to like.
No, you're that for sure. I mean, you're the only one who's ever made us fan art.
Which is the best. Oh my God, please do. It makes me so happy.
Now I want to hear you read to us.
All right. So this is a, I'm working on another novel. This is a excerpt. I don't think you need to know anything other than it's set in a moon base on the moon.
Ooh.
Awesome.
When I think of my child self, I think of the swans. I never saw them up close. Just tiny white specks on the artificial lake. Of course, I didn't know it was artificial at the time. I was just a girl. The child house with its imitation sky and grassland, the synthetic snow on the branches of the white birch trees, the long cycled seasons of childhood before we knew it was all underground, a replica Earth in miniature. There were cracks in the sky, the paint was peeling on the plains, but all that seemed natural too to my child self. They wanted us to grow up like they had, but it wasn't possible on the moon. The spell had to be broken at some point. I'm sure you remember your first night walk. Everyone does. But for the girls, it was different. Yes, we were told about the collapse of the Earth, the escape to the moon. Yes, we were put into the moon suits, which we had never seen before, and marched to the airlock. Yes, we were pushed out onto the forever gray plain, blinding sunlight, weightless bounce. But the difference with the girls, we were now left on our own. It was a harsh awakening. On the surface, we saw the world as it really was. Gone were the dimmable blue skies, the warm breeze, and the sound of the Swan Lake folding over the shore. The real sun was too bright to look at directly. The real Earth was reduced to a porthole of faraway blue. The forever night and empty starscape would kill us in seconds from mere exposure. Some were confused, some cried. I felt as blank as the black. We had to march to the safety of the next moon house. Everyone was scared we'd run out of oxygen. Footprints in the dust disappeared over the curved horizon. We set out on the path. To hesitate would mean death. We were almost there when one of the girls spotted something sparkling in the base of a crater far off the path. My earpiece crackled inside the suit. The other girls yelling, begging, and demanding, but she was already walking toward it, hypnotized by a shimmering mirage. The group stopped on the trail, and a few of us went to retrieve her. A large vein in the center of the crater had split open, spilling diorite down into the deep bottom, handfuls of diamond glinting in the sunlight. We arrived to find her staring at it, fascinated. I, in turn, became transfixed by her face, the way she looked at those rocks, curious, alive, beautiful. It was the first time I'd known desire. Someone else pulled the girl from her diorite reverie. When we finally saw the house, we bounded toward it, arriving on the last of our oxygen. My relief soon faded. The next house was another test of survival. The girls were competitive, cruel. I was not one of the popular ones. My only solace was the diorite girl, who featured heavily in my daydreams. I didn't dare approach her. And the night walks continued. They marched us out every month to feel the precariousness of our existence. One night walk, wandering blissfully alone, I saw my own glimmer of hope, a piece of diorite, the size and shape of an egg, winking up at me. Not way down in the bottom of a crater, but on the edge where I could reach it. I secreted the rock in my moon suit. I imagined holding it out to the girl and offering to make her eyes light up in the same way they had on that first night walk, and then her gaze shifting up to meet mine, that same look of curiosity and delight. No foreign objects were allowed in the house, no secrets. Over the next month, I could feel the diorite stone spark under my bed, even in the dead dark. We had a night walk coming soon, a plan formed. I would get her alone. I would tell her how I felt. But then one of the other girls found the stone. She said I had to throw it back or she'd tell. I was the last to pull on my moon suit for the night walk the next evening. All the girls knew my secret now. When we got to the edge of a crater, they gathered around to see what I would do. I pulled the diorite out of my pocket. I stared at it, sparkling speckled in the palm of my glove, but for too long. I hadn't seen its intended recipient join the onlookers. Suddenly, the girl's voice was there, whispering in my earpiece, "Is that diorite?" I froze. She approached me. My daydream began to unfold in front of my eyes. I held the rock out to her, just as I had imagined. Her face lit up with longing, just as I had imagined. Her eyes rose to meet mine, just as I had imagined. All my desire reflected back to me, a light shining in a mirror. The other girl stared. She reached out delicately as to not crush the precious egg, and I threw it back into the bottom of the crater. I turned and stumbled away as the rock descended half time, flickering in the sunlight behind me.
That was awesome.
That was beautiful, Zach.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I really want to know, like, how your brain, like, how your imagination works, because it feels like this is how you go. Like, you just have these vast worlds that you can riff on. Is it painful? Like, what's it like when you're writing these worlds? Is it fun?
Yeah, it's really fun. I love
it. Seems fun.
I mean, it feels like such a privilege. I mean, writing as a whole feels like such a privilege. But I think, you know, I've come to realize that it's really the world building is probably my favorite part of it. You know, the plot and the characters and the sentences, all of those things I struggle with, and I'm happy if I feel like they succeed a little bit, and I'm miserable when they fail, which is all mm-hmm. the time. But like mm-hmm. the world building, I could just go on and on with it forever. So in this particular book, you know, I had to figure out how does a moon base work, right? And what's the oxygen level in a moon suit? And I could just spend hours like clicking open Wikipedia tabs and, you know, wasting my life.
Oh man. Well, how, like, when did you start this novel? Where are you at with it? Like, what, where are we in your process right now?
Yeah. So I started it. I don't even want to do the exact math because it's depressing, but I think like 3 or 4 years ago, maybe even more. So I started it in Finland where I lived 3 or 4 years ago, and it's kind of infused with that, or I think of it as a novel from that time and place. But yeah, you know, I wrote a full draft there, and I think I've told you this, Lindsay, you know, I wrote this draft and I sent it to my agent, who's somebody that I value and trust, and he wrote me back and was like, you know, I was expecting pages and pages of feedback, because normally he's like, yeah, see what you're trying to do. This is where it's fallen apart. Here's what, you know, and it's really good. It's really helpful. But this time he was just kind of like, I don't get it. Doesn't seem like a thing.
Whoa.
And I was like, what? And yeah. So then like my whole my whole world fell apart. I fell into a ditch, and then I just like lay in a ditch. And then anybody who like came near me had to have a miserable conversation about it. And it was terrible. But then, and this is why I'm your number one fan. It was this podcast that helped me fall out of the ditch.
Or did it make you go deeper into the ditch?
Figured out the ditch was upside down, and I should.
Oh, that's so great! I love that.
Yeah, well, it was you, Lindsay. I think at some point in one of those first couple episodes, you were like, "Yeah, I had 10 minutes in the parking lot of the daycare, and so I wrote something," and I was just like, "Oh fuck! If Lindsay is taking 10 minutes in the parking lot of the daycare, then I got to get my shit together. Like, all my pieces are bullshit, and if I want to do this, then I got to climb out of the ditch and just do it," you know.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
I think it's like you have to like re-convince yourself over and over and over again that you're a capital W writer. Like, it never goes away. It never goes away that you, you know, like it's like something you have to keep doing. Who are we talking to? Maybe it was Erin Summers who was like, or maybe she tweeted this, like, "I just want to write the novel so that I never have to write the novel ever again."
Like, what? I'm ready to rest on my laurels like immediately.
Yes.
Right.
So then I crawled out of that ditch, and then I knocked all the game pieces off the table, and then I put it all back together, and then I hated it, and then I knocked them off again, and then now I'm trying to put it all back together again. But it is slow. Mm-hmm.
How long is this draft? What are we talking about here?
This is kind of embarrassing that I don't know the word count.
No, I mean, no, yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah,
you're living free.
Absolutely.
No, I would, except that I end up doing it all in InDesign because it lets me start to mess with design things, and then InDesign bafflingly does not have a word counter. Huh. So I have to do a very complicated thing to like figure out the exact word count, but I don't know, novel length.
When you say start to do design things, what does that mean for someone who knows nothing about design? What does that mean that you're doing while you're actually drafting, Zach?
Well, it's the stuff that I'm trying not to do, actually. I with both Bats and this one, I try and, because the writing part is the hard part for me, and you know, to what you're saying, Lindsay, about the capital W writer, I still can't help but to think of myself as a designer who's like moonlighting or, you know, scribbling on the side when I shouldn't be or something like that. But yeah, so I try and make myself write the whole thing, you know, in Word or Googly Docs or whatever, and then save the design for last because it's fun and it's easier for me, and it's not so, you know, it doesn't cut to the core of my insecurity or whatever. But inevitably I write something and I can't help it, and I bring it into InDesign and I start moving things around and changing fonts, like, you know, when you waste time picking out a font, like, that's how I waste all my time. And then inevitably the story doesn't work. Like, my agent was very correct about that. I have to change all the text, which means I have to change the design, and then it just becomes like a spaghetti nightmare mess.
It's like a process that is already cumbersome and impossible is now super cumbersome and impossible.
So dumb. With this one, I was like, I can do it in 2 years. The last Bats of the Republic took like 6 years. I was like, that's ridiculous. I will write this book in 2 years. And I think I'm on year four and starting over. So not a good clip.
I don't think 6 years is ridiculous though either. I mean, like, I don't know. I feel like six is still within the range of like, okay, yeah, that's not crazy. I don't know. Maybe it is, but I don't know. I just spent over five, and it like just slips. It just slips from you without even, I mean, it doesn't feel like five, but then you
do you want, Alex, do you want to spend another 5 years on the next one?
No, I want to still be alive at the end of this process. I don't want to have to leave off the
start
roof.
Over on that one and spend another 5 years.
Oh no, Zach, no.
I mean, Alex, I think you're totally right. Like when I was a reader and before I really tried to write, you know, I would read something by somebody that I loved and it'd be great. And I'd be like, when's the next book? This is genius. Just make another book. What are you doing? It's been 3 years, you know? And now I'm like, oh, it took you 10 years. Congratulations, you finished. You know?
Right. Absolutely.
Yep.
Right.
Ben was just pointing out that he was reading some, oh, he was, once again, I'm going to bring up him reading James McBride. How old is James McBride? He was like, well, he's in his 60s, honey. He's like, you know, you're only 41, you know? Oh, and then he's reading Lydia Millett's book right now. Same thing.
Children's Bible?
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, he's loving it.
I was just telling my wife, like, you're either like a prodigy at like 22 or something, or you make your masterwork when you're like 54.
Yeah, totally.
You know, I was mostly telling myself this, but yeah, she had to listen to it.
But it is. And it's like, and that whole time, it's not like you just woke up when you turned 54 and you were able to fart out this amazing masterpiece. It's like you were chugging along the way that we've all been chugging along, you know,
right.
And in design or no, and, you know, like making until something just kind of fell into place at the right time. And it's always about timing. Yeah. Big sigh.
It's hard, but also, I mean, how lucky, I mean, I think all the time about like my ancestors or even, you know, my great grandfather or something, all the generations before ours who had to, like, you know, plow the field or chase down the mammoth or whatever mundane task they had to do, you know, and just to be in that rarefied moment in history and socioeconomic whatever that I can pour time on something completely made up. I mean, just feels so lucky. I love it at the same time.
Yeah.
I know, it does feel ridiculous to complain. Like when I'm like sitting on my fat butt on the couch, just like, oh, I need to make the words come. And it's like my grandfather had a farm, you know, and like had to spend, you know, backbreaking weeks picking rocks out of his field by hand so that he could plow, you know, and it's like, oh, I want to make a metaphor. Yeah.
Part of the pleasure is in the complaining. I don't know.
It is.
No, it definitely is. I definitely agree with that. Maybe as you were describing what your drafting process is like, I thought, my God, it's a good thing that I can only do one thing. If I had another skill set, I would absolutely do that. I would just try and like a related skill set to writing that was, I could somehow bring into the process. If I could had any kind of visual talent, oh my God, that sounds like it in some ways would be so tempting to just do. As you were describing it, I was like, oh my God, yes, I understand that.
Are you able to make like maps and stuff in InDesign, or is it mainly like layout and, you know, like as you're world building, are you like drawing, you know, are you drawing the, where they live on the moon and, you know, like as you're going?
Yes, totally. So I've made, you know, moon-based diagram after moon-based diagram.
Awesome.
That's another one, you know, design of the moon suit, right? Like there's something you can waste, you know, hours and weeks on end, you know, figuring out exactly what does it look like, right? But no, I don't know. It's great. I think it's a blessing and a curse. I mean, I think one thing that I've realized now that I'm older is like I finally figured out what I'm supposed to be, and it's a like a dilettante or something, you know, like I can't do I don't know if it's a skill set, but it does do something for me in that when I get really stuck in the writing, I can switch over and try and draw something or make something for a while. And it's often satisfying because it comes quickly and I can satisfy myself in that process relatively quickly. Whereas like the writing, I'm just never happy with and I'm never going to be happy with. But then it gets a little boring or too easy, or design only goes so deep, you know. Yeah. It's a surfacey thing in the end, right? There's not, There's not the same, you can't make the same kind of meaning that like a really good novel can make from all its parts, you know? So then I inevitably go back and try and write and cry.
Do you find that like going back to it after being in the visual side, like deepens it in some way, or is it hard to sort of access that part?
It helps sometimes. Sometimes I'm like, oh, now I really know what that room looks like, or I really know what that character looks like. I think even Carol Anshaw, who I'm sure you know.
Oh, yes, I love her.
Yeah, said one time she always just, she draws whatever house or if there's a main setting, she draws just the floor plan so that nobody turns like the wrong corner at the wrong time or something. Oh. But even that kind of visualization, I think, can really help make things concrete, you know?
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, when I was studying theater in high school, we did these like mime exercises and I sucked so bad at them because it'd be like, okay, like the teacher would say, like, you're holding a glass of water and you're going to sit in a chair and you're going to turn on the TV. And I would like hold my glass of water. I'd sit in the chair and all of a sudden the glass of water was not in my hand anymore. I didn't like, I couldn't remember to put it down, you know, I couldn't. And then like, I was holding the remote in one hand and then all of a sudden it was the other hand. And I think that's so similar to when you're writing something, you know, and you're like describing a place or you're in the room or whatever. And sometimes it's very like free flowing and you can see it immediately. And then other times it's just like, and then they put the table in the corner and then they sit in the chair, you know? And so you're like, wait a minute, you know, like, weren't they in the bathroom? Like, why is there a bureau in there? You know? And it's just like, I think it's similar to, you know, like what you're talking about. Like you need to sort of agree on what things look like as you're going through. And it's nice too, in a novel, you can't hold it all in your head. And like a room, the way a room looked like when you were writing it in June, and then you go back to it in December, you're like, what the, you know, like, huh? it's so hard.
I was talking to our buddy, Adam Price, who was on the show, about where you get just like, okay, if you're writing a story and there's a house in the story, do you always default to the same house without thinking? Or if you are writing about, you know, a particular, like if you're writing about a storefront, is it always the same storefront? And I always do default to like the same house and then have to be modulating off of that, which seems like in a way like the opposite of what Zach is describing. I have to like dumb it down as much as possible, use the same like single Lego block and then say, okay, now it's going to be green this time, and like trick myself that what I'm doing is any different than before. I just have to make the problem as small as possible. That's like my obsession.
Well, yeah. And I think also you can be obsessed with those kinds of places. Like I think of Anne Tyler, like every Anne Tyler book is set in a Baltimore, like clapboard house, you know?
Right. Right.
And probably because she lives in one of them, you know, and it's just, she can vibe off of that for book after book after book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Alex, I would say that's the way it works in everyone's brain. There's this book called What We See When We Read, which is by Peter Mendelsohn, who's a fantastic book designer, one of my favorite book designers. And he talks in, it's all about kind of like, you know, what happens inside your brain, their kind of reader imagination. And he uses the example of a dock, and he's like, oh, imagine this dock, it's late at night, there's the dock, he like sets a whole scene, and then he kind of freezes you. And he's like, okay, go back and look more closely at that dock. Like, where did that particular dock come from? Because as a reader or imaginer, you filled it in from a childhood memory or a movie, you know, is right. It a long wooden dock? Is it an industrial dock? Right. So like every time you do that in writing, like you say a car or a candle, you like call that reader's default thing up out of their own memory or experience, which is totally amazing and uncontrollable and magic at the same time.
It is magic. Are you able to isolate out what the default starting point is for this project? Do you have a sense of what the visual spark was, if there was one?
I think a lot of the visuals were inspired by Finland. There's a very different like aesthetic there. But also Biosphere 2. You guys know Biosphere 2?
No.
No.
So in the Arizona desert, Alex, it would fit in the Phoenix UFO
Oh, yeah.
World. Yeah. There's in the 90s, well, you know, do you remember Biodome? What about Biodome?
For sure. Or,
totally. Okay.
So that one we know.
Good, that's good. So yeah, that one was based on the real biosphere, which was, you know, this thing they built in the Arizona desert, which was kind of like a moon base, a giant glass house. And they tried to have all the ecosystems inside it. And this was in the 90s. And I went as a kid, it was not that far from El Paso, Texas, where I grew up. So, you know, my parents looking for road trips, we went out to Biosphere. While the I think there were nine in there, the Biospherians were like locked, sealed inside for 2 years, you know, and looked at them through the glass like zoo animals or whatever. And, but when I was a kid, I was just, I mean, my imagination was totally captured by this gigantic biosphere, which was like a moon base and these astronaut looking people inside. And so then, you know, thinking about that some years ago, I started to, they've made a documentary now and you can read a lot more about it. But Jane Pointner, one of the women inside, wrote a kind of like a tell-all memoir, you know, like who was sleeping with who and who hated who and everybody hated everybody. And it was a disaster. There were no scientists involved. They were kind of more like a new agey cult that did this. The whole thing didn't work. Like the ecosystem, like they put a bunch of bees in there to like pollinate the flowers. Bees flew into the glass on day one and all died.
Oh my gosh.
And by the end, they like only had sweet potatoes. All their skin turned orange because they were only eating sweet potatoes and starving. It's an amazing story. But anyway, so that's kind of where the moon base came from, is the fascination with that place and just the way that whenever there's a group of people, even a small group of people, it seems like they need to divide and hate each other for I don't know what reason, but that kind of whole dynamic. Anyway, it's still there. You can go inside and tour it as a tourist.
Jeez.
It's really a crazy story. For a while, like they tried to, when the first one failed, they tried to restart it with scientists. Steve Bannon was in charge of it.
What the
fuck? And his or Biosphere's story. Nothing about it makes sense. The whole thing was financed by a Texas oil billionaire.
Huh.
When you were saying earlier that you, I think you put it that you moved all the game pieces, you threw them off the table and then you put them all back in a different way. Like, what does that mean? You know, are you moving sections or... Jamie Attenberg calls it breaking your book. She breaks her book a number of times when she's revising.
Yes, I think that's a good phrase for it. She's a great writer. Yeah, and Bats, I felt like I broke many times before it finally was right. I guess this time it was really plotting things out. Again, I knew the setting and the world building was solid and the characters were pretty much there, but you know, I mean, my agent's feedback was a little bit longer, but he was like, yeah, I'm not really feeling a plot or stakes. And I don't know, that's just really hard for me. I don't know when this was, a few months or a few years ago, but there was a tweet Patrick Somerville wrote on Twitter. I don't know how many times I have to say it, plot is character. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, like that tweet, you know? And I'm like, yeah, that's right. And I'm like, what does that mean? I don't know. How do you do that? I don't know what you're talking about, you know? So I think I'm trying to get the plot and the character things aligned.
Alex, do you know what that means? Because you studied with Patrick.
I did study with Patrick. I don't know what that means. I mean, other than...
Sounds,
I mean,
good though, right?
Oh, it sounds great. I mean, absolutely. But... I'd repeat things that Patrick taught us all the time. He's the one who taught me the have one character go after one thing that I literally use all the time.
Well, that sounds like what it is then, right?
I mean, in a way, yeah. I get, actually, you know, it's not that different from what we were talking about related to that, Lindsay, where you can just fall back on having one character pursuing one thing when you forget what the book is. It's an easy way to kind of recalibrate yourself, reorient yourself within the work. And yeah, in that way, that is plot housed within character. So yeah, we'll say that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, I remember when you mentioned that on one episode, and I thought, oh, that's so great. And then I thought about my own book, and I was like, okay, what's my like one character and their one thing? And then, nope, I don't have that.
But maybe your plot is your character. Next time. Yeah, next time. Oh, I know. It's heartbreaking.
Now I'm falling into a ditch.
Nope. Get out of the ditch.
No, get out.
Nope. Your book is making its own rules, and then it's going to touch the bear, and it's going to be fine.
Right. That's going
to
be fine.
Oh, I love touching the bear. I need to make some fan art about touching the bear.
Yes. Try to touch the bear. Blair Hurley. Thank you, Blair Hurley. I wonder if she has any clue how much we love that. Well, how do you get this work?
Under a bearskin rug.
There you go. That should be cheap and easy. How do you get this work done? Because you're extremely busy. You have two kids. You are teaching. You're getting your PhD. What does it look like when you're working? How do you get it done?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I love listening to you guys talk about this stuff, is because I relate to that. To that struggle of time and the bargaining of time with a partner and a family, job, and life, you know? But yeah, for me, I mean, my beautiful wife gifts me time sometimes, and every once in a while, like a nice chunk of like a few days or something where I can go away and like do something, which is amazing when that happens, of course. But mostly I steal time from work, And I'm lucky in the, you know, it's kind of built into the job, right? Like you're supposed to be doing research, and I look up a lot of academic words and I put them around my synopsis to make it into research, you know? but that allows me to kind of steal some time from work, but it's not much, it's hard. I've been one day a week now getting up at like 6 a.m. and leaving the house, this is another gift from the wife, leaving the house before anybody else is awake, which means that I can skip the like 2 to 3 hours it takes to like make everyone breakfast, get everyone dressed, convince them to get in the car, take them to school, go back, get the book bag, all of these kinds of things, you know? So
I'm amazed that they sleep past 6 o'clock. Tell me your secrets.
Oh, they don't always, especially my daughter. She is, she's in charge of the whole operation.
Oh man, I can relate to that.
No, I will wake up at 5 sometimes and I'll be wide awake and I'll think, okay, I'm going to go downstairs. I'm going to be so quiet. I'm going to go downstairs and I'm going to go do X, Y, Z. And within like 20 minutes, the whole house is awake, you know, like they hear, they're just waiting for any excuse to come out. So yeah.
About half the time that I've had one of those mornings, it's been thwarted by something like that, or you know, somebody has a fever or whatever, you know. Whatever.
Yes. How did you know? Because I know you don't know right now, but how did you know, like when Bats was done? Like, how did you think to yourself, like, this is finished?
Well, by publication. I mean, that was the blessing of having it printed. You know, I couldn't mess with it. And at some point, actually near the end. It might have already been sold, and but I was still tinkering with it and still changing things, and I had this like take it back moment where I thought, you know what, I like just tinkering with this. Do I want to publish it? Maybe I'll just tinker with this for the rest of my life. It's like my hobby in the garage, and I don't have to publish it.
Did you really think that?
What's that?
You really thought that?
I did.
You just scared.
Wow.
Well, yes, I was terrified. But I did have that thought. You know, I considered it for a second. And, you know, I thought, oh, well, the right thing to do is obviously put it out and then, like, pick up the next one or make the next one or build the next wind-up toy, right? Like, go on to the next one. That's the way to start over and keep things moving. So, yeah, I'm happy with Bats in a lot of ways, but of course if I was still tinkering on it, would change a million things. Isn't that always true? Don't you guys feel that way?
I find Alex yells at me about this a lot, but I find that I have all this like these hang-ups about my books, and like you know, then sometimes I'll actually look at them and I'm like, oh, they're not so bad.
Yeah, they're not so bad.
Yeah, I think from book to book, I'm trying to, like, you know, grow, man, but also like fix whatever flaw stood out the most for me in the previous book, or like challenge myself in a new way. And that can be like a bewildering place, because like it's a starting point that only you know about, you know, and it can be hard to remember, you know, like what you were doing in the first place. So
that satisfaction, though, is like fuel. I think it does make you want to do the next one, or you have this constant feeling of like, oh, I can do it better. I know I can get better at that, or, you know.
I will get that Kirkus starred review if it's the last thing I fucking do.
Oh my God. I try and think all the time, okay, do your work and then step back. Just do your work and then step back. Leave it alone. Because I don't know if I'm a tinkerer by nature in the same way as you, Zach, but I can definitely fall into just like, wow, this is fucking garbage. And I can just kind of wallow in that. But I mean, I don't know. I really just think about trying to do something different, take a bigger swing, do something stranger. But yeah, I don't know. I reach a point where I really do just want to be done with it. And so, yeah, I don't think I'm built tough enough to stay in a project for much longer than I am on this one currently already, actually.
But if you're staying in the activity, I mean, I think that's so much about it too. And not thinking about that Kirkus star or whatever, whatever prize. There was this, when I was in Finland, I was listening to this Finnish rapper speak, Papadi T. You should look him up, because it's amazing to watch Finnish rap. And he was saying how he used to get very caught up in the marketing and the image and all the other stuff around his music. And then he realized he just had to stop and make the songs. And that was his part. That was his job in the whole ecosystem, to make the songs as best that he could and let somebody else worry about all the rest of the stuff, which I don't know. I think there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, having been a publisher, the rest of that stuff is it's its own can of worms, you know?
It is. There is that horrifying questionnaire that they give you where you're supposed to think like that. Cause like their publicity department doesn't know you, you know, like the way that your editor does. And so they want to know like how to market you. And this is, I'm talking about like the big houses. There's all these questions.
Don't fill that out. When you're having the author freak out, that's like the author busy work that they give you to like keep you distracted and call me make you think you can't do it without them, or I don't know. It's a cynical take, but
well, it's like name some influential people you know that we can send books to, and it's like I don't what my mom I guess. And then you just feel like, if you know, like as if you're a writer first starting out and you're not really of that world, you're just kind of like, oh shit, I am doomed. Like I have nothing to offer you but the work. Like literally that's all I thought I had to do. I guess that's not true, you know.
But I do think it is true, you know, like I think all that marketing stuff, having tried and albeit mostly failed to market books myself, I think the best thing that you can do is have an amazing book, you know, because it doesn't matter the ads or the reviews or anything like that. I think the thing that makes people read a book is somebody they know, their friend that they trust, tells them, oh my gosh, you got to read this book.
Yes.
Like it's amazing. It will blow your mind. Like that's the thing that makes the chain reaction happen. It gets the next person to read, that starts the snowball. And the only thing that you can do is have a book that's good enough that somebody, when they're done, instead of just going, it turns to their friend and is like, you have to read this.
Mm-hmm.
That's so true. It really is. I mean, that's what works on me as a reader.
Definitely.
Like you hear all the hyped books, but I never really like go get the book until I see people talking about it, that people that I trust, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was talking about this with my agent because, you know, like we recently tried to sell a novel that was plotless. It was basically about time, you know, time and motherhood and family. And it was really just exploring these people's lives, like in various chronological and non-chronological ways. And like he sees it very clearly and like gets it. But it doesn't seem like the type of thing that's going to sell. And
I'm so mad about it. I have not read that book. You don't ever send me your drafts, but I'm furious.
I send nobody my drafts. I was proud of it, but I said to him, you know, I wish I would have thought more about like a book that could sell. Like I never, ever thought to myself, let me write a book that publishers are, you know, going to want to buy. I never thought that. And I was beating myself up about it. Cause I feel like as a, you know, as a writer who's been doing this for 2 decades, basically, that I should know better. I should be thinking about the market. I should be thinking about the readers, you know? And he was like, I actually don't think that's the right thing to do. You know, and he kind of like, you know, he was like, no, I think you have to write the book that you want to write. And then at that point we have to talk about, you know, all the business side of it.
I agree.
But it can end in heartbreak, you know, like you can write the book you wanted to write and it can end with nobody, you know, with nobody wanting it. So.
But how much, percentage wise, what do you think your like satisfaction from having made the thing the way that you wanted it to be versus the having it be published and go out and you know how it feels to have a book in the world and have
it feels life terrible.
And some amazing things happen, some bad things, you know?
No, I know. And I think I'm of two minds because I, you know, like I've talked about how I keep it in my nightstand and I pet it like a little, you know, pet and I check in on it and I love it. And so I'm really like happy with that. And I like the feeling I had when I was writing it and the feeling I had when I knew it was done was really special. So that's one part of it. But the other part of it is this really scary thing that I put on myself that I don't think it's totally my fault, but just being a 41-year-old woman writer in this industry, like, and I know it's getting better, but it can make me feel like I want permission to publish the next book. I want to make another book. I want to keep making books. So to be told no is so scary. But I have a great agent and, you know, like, so we'll see, but it is like, I know that's a lot of it's in my head, but a lot of it's not in my head too. You know, like we celebrate like the debut author so much and the young author and all that. And like, I've had these periods in my career where I've thought like, I have to be so pretty, you know, like if I can just make myself so pretty, then my books will sell, you know? And that's so sad. Like, where's that coming from? You know, I know it's coming from me, but it's coming from other things too that I've noticed. So anyway, that's just the stuff that I have to fight. And I think like this process is making me a better writer and it's making me like own it more than I think I ever have in my career before, which has been useful for what I'm working on now, which is a total rewrite of the book, but
which you're excited about.
I'm very, I'm very excited. It's fun.
And the parts that you've read are amazing. I mean, I think you did the exact right. You've done the exact right thing in reaction to that holding pattern or rejection or whatever is happening with the one that's out on submission, which is just to like, you did this podcast, you're writing you're writing the next thing, which is the thing to do, you know? And I agree with your agent. I don't think that you should write to guess what the market wants to buy. Even the market doesn't know what it wants to buy, you know?
It doesn't. And that was his point. And he was like, so often if people do that, if they write toward, oh, this is going to be big, then it flops, you know? And I know I don't have it in me to be like, ooh, I'm going to write this YA novel about like a girl who, you know, can like grow an arm whatever. See, I can't even come with an idea. Ben's laughing.
Where's the arm coming from? Is it right-handed? Is it another left?
Get this. She grows an arm. How often have you wanted an extra arm? Faceless publisher.
The jacket copy is writing itself. I'll design the cover right now.
There you go.
Like an arm on a floral pattern.
Her name is Tri-Arm. It rolls off the tongue. Anyway, this is about you, Zach.
I think Tri-Arm is about me in a way too.
It is, because how many freaking balls do you have in the air, you know?
Several.
Well,
you're a Renaissance man.
There was a designer in Chicago who I admired a lot. He was the art director for Chicago, but he had for Time Out Chicago, he had a million things going on. He was doing Punk Planet and the skateboard magazine, and he had his own art gallery with his wife, and was also a painter, and just
whoa.
You know, I met him when I was in my early 20s, and he just seemed to be doing a million things, and I couldn't help it. I was just like, how are you like five people? How is it possible to do all this stuff? And he said, I just half-ass it all. That sounds like the ticket. My life solved.
That's definitely a tactic, I will say, that
what
I have
an amazing
employed.
Answer. I love that guy. Whoever that guy is, I love that guy.
He's probably half-assing like half a dozen things as we speak. You know?
Oh man.
Brilliant. I half-ass a lot of things, and then other things I fake.
Yes. The faking it till you make it, or just, you know. It's very powerful.
It's a great strategy, actually.
It is.
Do your kids know that you're a writer? Do they like look at your books, ask you about that stuff?
I think maybe still too young. So yeah. My son, who's my oldest, is 5. So he has some vague sense of that. His friend, who is 6 and wants to be like a children's book author, was very impressed and had some. But Soren, my son, I don't think he cares. But he does, you know, he tries to make his own little books, which I delight in. So we've sat there while he writes just whatever comes into his mind and draws, and then we tape it all together. And I think that's so cool. They're hilarious. Quickies was so great. I remember the first Quickies, I'll never forget.
Oh, I was trying so hard to impress you.
In the first Quickies?
Yes.
No.
Mary told me who you were. Yes. Yeah. And I was like, you know, like I wanted to do a book with you guys. I was hoping
Yes. This is revisionist.
It's not.
Alex, I'll tell you the real story. Okay.
No, this is not. It's not revisionist. You can ask Ben. He's right here playing Animal Crossing.
Get some fish, Ben.
Case in point. So Quickies, you know, was such a wild success. I mean, like, everybody loved it. Every time they did it, everybody showed up. Lindsay was the star of the show always, because she just reads in this incredible way that like just captivates and enraptures everybody, right? It's like, I can't tell you how many times I was the host of this reading or that event or whatever. And before the event, every other reader would come up to me. I'd be like, when do you want to go? And they'd be like, can you not put me after Lindsay? Every single person. And then I'd just be like, yep, guess Lindsay's the headliner again, because nobody can follow. But anyway, I'll just Quickies, I feel like for a year, both Jonathan and I begged you, like, put these things together in a book. We'll publish a book, whatever, as many as you want, as few as you want, call it whatever you want. We want to make a book out of it. And you were like, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. You guys seem like idiots.
No, Zach. Okay. I have these voices in my head that tell me that people are just being polite because they feel sorry for me. And I honestly believed that. I didn't think you guys were serious. And it wasn't until I think you both were just like.
Our rule at Featherproof was we had to agree, right, on a book to publish it, which was actually a good way of narrowing it down because our tastes were pretty different, you know, and the Venn diagram in the middle. But normally us agreeing meant like one person was like, well, okay, this time. But your book, I think, you know, I mean, both Jonathan and I were chasing you. I don't even think we both knew it. For a few months, you know, it was definitely the one where the Venn diagrams overlapped and we were both 100%. We need to publish this now.
That book still sells. Like Featherproof is still, you know, it's not like selling hundreds of copies, but it still sells at a pretty good clip.
Yeah. Featherproof it's exists, amazing. Which is also like amazing to me. I'm so happy that Tim and now Jason, like, kept it going and kept putting out books.
Really great books. They always have such good taste. You guys, the product has always, always been so good and so unique, and like showcasing writers that you didn't, you know, that you wouldn't have seen otherwise.
You want to hear about the next book?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I'm supposed to say about it. So it's a book by a Finnish woman that I know, Juliana Hudi. And it's a graphic novel. It's going to be Featherproof's first, or they're short stories actually, but in graphic novel form. And it's incredible. Lindsay, I think you will love it. Like the aesthetics of it.
I'm so excited. The storytelling
and the drawing, it's like amazing. And
whoa.
Yeah, I have been helping, I guess, you know, with the design and the helping Jason figure out graphic novels, which I don't really know myself, and trying to translate Finnish, which I also don't know.
Oh man.
But I had that old like publisher instinct, or that's the wrong word, just that like excitement that I couldn't not see it happen in the world. So I hope that comes out sometime in the fall, but it's called The Nightingale That Never Sang.
Oh.
Yeah. It's gonna be
amazing.
Good.
So you brought her to them.
I did.
Yes.
I did. The That's book awesome. Was published in Finland, and it won like every award in Finland. It won all these grants. Like the main newspaper is like everybody hail our next creative genius. And, you know, the US just doesn't publish in translation, or so few people do, or so few Finns get outside of their country or their sphere. And it's just, the work is clearly so worthy that it just has to have a bigger audience, I think.
Okay, well, I think we've done it.
We've done it.
Oh my gosh, it can't be over already.
It's a wham bam thank you ma'am.
Well, now comes the part of the show where like you hang up on me, and then the two of you go off by yourselves and you're like, that was great, that was really fun. Oh,
yeah,
that was great.
Yeah, that's what we say every time, and we mean it every time. Yeah,
no, I can tell when you don't. And I'm worried about it.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, I'm kidding. Well, no. I also like the part where you have to ask each other, or, you know, did you get any work done? Which like clearly it's like, so it's, you know, part of it is checking in, holding each other accountable, that kind of thing. And you're trying to be like real friendly and casual about like, so did you get any work done? But you clearly do not want to ask that.
I'm going to slip my wrist after this episode.
I'm bleeding out right now. So fuck both of you.
My fan take. I love it. It's my favorite part.
One time Alex was like, yo, we got to mix it up. We're just going to like ask each other these like wild card questions. There's going to be out of left field. It's going to be whatever. We're going to come up with them. And then we're going to surprise each other with them. So then like the next episode rolls around and I was like, okay, are we going to do that thing? And he's like, yeah, but I fucking forgot we were going to do it, so I have nothing.
How was your week?
That's pro move. What was your question for him?
I don't even remember.
Yeah. See, we're really good at this.
I think it was going to be something about some movie I watched or something like that, but you know, it's what? Funny. He didn't deserve it,
yeah, so
he
didn't get it. That's fine.
Yeah. Okay, Zach, we release you.
All right, thank you both.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
He seems like the best guy.
Wait, what should we say instead of that was great?
Yeah, ours has to be, okay, yeah, we have to
say, man, that was all right.
We have to be even more aggressive than that.
Okay.
I think we should.
God, what a dud.
I can't keep a straight face. I'm too tired.
Snooze. I have never met such a creative person ever in my life. And when I was making Daddies with him, I had all these like, it was my first book. I didn't know anything, and I didn't know like what the possibilities were. And you know, like originally we were going to make them packs of cigarettes, and each story was going to be rolled up like a cigarette.
Holy Christ.
But there was some other collection of books that were coming out with a like a similar design, not the cigarette part, but like the covers looked like cigarette boxes. So we punted on that. And then I said, you know, I keep thinking of like this fishing tackle box, like the, it could be like daddy's fishing tackle box full of stories and other things. And he, I told you this before, he ordered a fishing tackle box, an old fishing tackle box off of eBay, and literally like scanned it into the computer. And then we designed it, you know, like he wanted me to say like what images would go with what story. And then like he made those happen. And, you know, like I had the idea of using like my eighth grade school photo as my author photo. And like, he just, it was so fun. He was right there with me, you know, like it's unique to publish with a small press because everyone there, like J. Robert Lennon was saying, has read your book. They're very excited about it. They, you know, like they're completely devoted to you. And your publisher is also your designer, you know, like it's just, it's so special. And like, you know, I would go to his apartment and we would look at things together and like talk things through. And he would, you know, he's just exploding with ideas all the time. And like, if anyone, if you're not familiar with Bats of the Republic, which is the novel that he was referencing, it's his second book. His first book is boring, 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 boring. That's the title of it. That's not my assessment of it. It's insane. He designed every inch of that book, Bats of the Republic, and boring as well, but Bats of the Republic is wild. And he's just amazing. He's just, I wish I had that kind of brain. I wish I, you know, I don't even know how to work Photoshop. So it's just really cool.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and Featherproof is like legendary. I mean, I moved to Chicago in 2005.
Me too.
Yeah, well, there you go. And a lot of those books were starting to come out maybe like, what, 5 or 6 years after that. And I feel like Featherproof was just everywhere. And I mean, you still look at those covers now, the Christian DeBordo book, Patrick Somerville book, your book, the Blake Butler book. I mean, like those are, I don't know. I feel like those are just absolutely legendary books, and the covers are all fucking insane.
I remember when I saw the cover for The Awful Possibilities, I was like, ugh.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's that one really pops. It's still, I'm pulling up right now. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. Everyone go to ZachDodson.com. And then just look at his narrative design because it is
unreal.
Like every image is bursting, like literally bursting with with design.
You guys mentioned Carol Anshaw at one point, and I read a story of hers when I was in grad school. Shauna Seeley, who was one of my professors, assigned a story called The Last Speaker of the Language. Do you know that one?
No, I've only read her most recent novel, I think.
This story, you would love it, actually. But this story was so good that I like found her email, and I was like, I sent her an email, and it's funny. I pulled it up while you guys were talking. I was like, I was trying to remember if that was right. And but if anyone's out there, it's probably Googleable. You can probably find it. But Carol Anshaw is The Last Speaker of the Language. It's just a knock you out stunning short story, and her name came up, so I wanted to shout out.
She's incredible, and I got to study with her, and awesome. She's just very like frank and open and hilarious. I guess Zach must have studied with her as well because he went to the Art Institute for grad school too.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But she's also the person who was like, yeah, if you want to write, you probably shouldn't teach. Which is bonkers because she teaches and, you know, like then she writes all the time. So
yeah,
probably just being curmudgeonly that day.
Well, but I also would love to hear like, you know, what was behind that comment, because who knows? I feel like there could be like a whole logic to it that you can't see hearing it on the end. I mean, I feel like so many of those types of opinions calcify so rigidly, in book world that it's hard to kind of even parse out a simple statement like that. Like, what are you actually telling me?
Yeah. And she could have been joking and I just didn't get it.
Totally. Or that too.
I was a young buck.
Young buck.
Parker was asking me or maybe it was Towns. My 5-year-old was like, what's a kid? Like, how old is a kid, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, people are kids until they're 25.
I was going to say 27. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, and as I said it, like I said it as a joke. And then I was like, no, but I actually really believe that. Like, you're a child until you're 25.
Yeah. And men longer.
And then as long as you choose after that.
Yeah.
I finished reading Lisa Taddeo's new book, Animal.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, I mean, talk about touching the bear.
Touch that bear.
As I was texting Alex about this earlier, it's like the bears at this point are running in terror. Because that book is just bear after bear getting touched.
You were warned by the title.
It's true. Animal. There you go. I loved it. It was just my kind of book. And I can't wait to talk to her about it.
Yeah, I'm excited to read it.
All right.
All right, buddy.
Talk to you later.
Bye. Bye.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Hickley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.
Poop jokes aren't my favorite kind of jokes, but they are my number two.
Yeah, it's like, oh,